This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. As we go to air a little after noon, officials in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, not far from the Maine border, are still working to uncover just what went wrong in a terrible train derailment this weekend. A parked train carrying more than 70 cars of crude oil somehow came free and traveled into the small town, derailing and exploding early Saturday morning. The death toll currently stands at 5, but officials warn that is expected to rise, with 40 people still unaccounted for. Laura Beeston, city reporter with the Montreal Gazette, is on the scene where she's been reporting for the newspaper, and she joins us now. Laura, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Have there been any new developments this morning that we should be aware of?
It seemed that last night the work that they had hoped to get done was a little bit stalled because it was a hazard area. It was hazardous on site. So actually, since yesterday, there hasn't really been any developments. The biggest thing is that the perimeter around the evacuation perimeter has been drawn back more towards the scene of the incident. So some locals are able to start going back to their homes and get their belongings, feed their pets, and, you know, try to keep going on, business as usual, although it's obviously quite difficult.
How many people were evacuated?
In total, there was about 2,000 people that were evacuated. It was evacuated in waves. Initially, there was about 1,000 people taken out of the city core. And then later on, they were worried about the air quality over a neighborhood called Fatima, which is just south. Some Environmental Canada ministers have been, spokespeople have said that, it's looking like the air quality is good. So hopefully those folks can get back home as well in the next few hours, they hope, or a few days.
What do we know right now about why the train came loose? Its brakes were put on by a train engineer on Friday night when he parked it above the town for a mandatory rest. That much is confirmed, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. There's a little bit that's still one of the big questions that the investigation is trying to uncover is what exactly happened. I don't think that they can tell us anything really with any certitude for a little while, but they have found two black boxes with all of the train information in it. So Transportation Safety Board is currently analyzing sort of the clues of the accident, but they're unable to say sort of how it happened.
Is there any indication that something may have been done by fire officials? They were actually called to the train before it came loose for a fire that was put out before this whole thing happened.
The investigators said that they have only confirmed the reports of the fire. So they've confirmed reports, but there's no other information actually available on that specific front. Like I said, this is one of those things where we're being told that we're just going to have to be patient and wait for people to do their job, because the first thing over the last 48 hours was essentially to get the site to a place where investigators could start rolling in and seeing, you know, what's going on, what happened. So that's where we're at. It's a slow-moving process. The fire only really was put out yesterday evening after 36 hours. So just to give you the idea of the, like, destruction, it was quite a long process. There were four different firefighter units coming in. I think that there were three units that actually came up from the United States of America to come help battle the flames. But it was just an enormous task for the first responders to get the location to a point where people could move in and investigate. And that's where we are now. And the investigators are saying, you know, they're not even doing media interviews really today because they just have to roll up their sleeves and get to work on trying to determine what caused this incident.
Laura, I understand that you showed up in the town Saturday morning, and as you said, the fire was still going on Saturday morning, wasn't controlled until yesterday evening. What did the scene look like?
Oh, sorry. No,
yeah,
I was called on Saturday night.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah. Saturday night then, even. I mean, it sounds like this fire was very difficult to put out. What did the scene look like when you got there?
When we arrived, I arrived at about 9 o'clock on Saturday evening. It's about a 3-hour drive from Montreal. So we, yeah, I was called in the afternoon. We came in, arrived at 9. Essentially, I was standing at about, well, I guess, 500 or more meters from the site. Must have been more. And you could still see over the tree line a huge, huge flame. You could hear the crackling over the sound of, you know, concerned citizens just basically standing there watching their downtown center burn, and talking about people who are missing and talking about escaping the fire. It was really something. I will note, there's a huge resilience of every sort of resident we've been talking to has been just so generous with talking about their stories and about their town, and people are really coming together here, and so I've been really moved by that. But the actual physical scene was just it's unbelievable how big this thing was. I mean, I'm not sure if you saw any of the aerial photos, but it's just incredible. If you take a look at the scope of the damage, there are 4 or 5 blocks that are just gone. Commercial, residential, the downtown core. There are some ancestral buildings. This town is a railroad town, and its library and its archives are gone. It's just the level of destruction is incredible. I can't impress that enough. And it's in the middle of such a beautiful place, you know, like around all this destruction is just the most picturesque, you know, scenery that you could possibly imagine. It's quite lovely and then also quite devastating.
We actually have a link to the Montreal Gazette on our Facebook page. The Montreal Gazette, which Laura Beeston works for, has some pretty incredible pictures of the scene. You can find them by going to the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Laura, you mentioned that townspeople are really coming together and being very resilient. Nonetheless, 5 confirmed dead, 40 still unaccounted for, and I've been reading that it's possible some bodies may never be identified because they've basically been incinerated. I mean, this must be devastating for a small town.
Right. Yeah, exactly. No, it's absolutely devastating. And I think that people, I get the sense, I was talking to someone who has been brought in to do some crisis counseling, and he was telling me that he gets the sense that the true impacts of what happened here won't be felt by people for at least a couple days. People are still sort of running on adrenaline, it feels like, and people are still sharing their stories. But I don't think, you know, but a lot of, you know, we haven't even been able to go back down to Centreville. I'm sure that as soon as townspeople are able to actually go and see it for themselves, that's when it's really going to sink in. You know, also the other thing is that when you have someone missing and not confirmed dead, there's still that hope that they could be found, that they could be found. So it's not as final as finding a body or knowing for certain what happened. And I think that that is what people are going to be coming to terms to, according to this crisis counselor I was speaking with. But yeah, for now, there is a Red Cross sort of location set up in the local high school. There's a lot of aid that's coming in. Our Prime Minister Stephen Harper was in town to check it out. Same with the Premier was in town just to take a look at the devastation. So, I mean, I feel like people are coming together, but it's also one of those things where until we know really the extent of the damage and the extent of the loss, it's really not going to hit people until these details are revealed.
Laura Beeston with the Montreal Gazette updating us on the train derailment and fire in Quebec. Laura, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right, we are going to switch gears when we come back and talk a little bit about camping, a favorite summer activity, but one that is often accompanied by mosquitoes, leaky tents, and other minor maladies. Listeners, you can share your favorite camping disaster memories with us at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. When I was about 11, my father, my stepmother, my younger brother, and I all piled into a car we affectionately called the Anteater because of its very strange shape, and we camped our way from Maine to California and back home to Vermont. It was an epic one-month adventure. We stayed in campgrounds that varied in scenic offerings from a multi-lane highway view to a lakeside Yellowstone gorgeous campsite. And we learned quickly how not fun it is to wake up with an inch of rain at the bottom of your tent, or to a breakaway mosquito that has spent the whole night at the all-you-can-eat human buffet. To top it all off, my brother decided he was afraid of rain that summer, and we had a lot of it. And I was just starting to hit puberty, and for some reason needed to go cry and be by myself pretty much every evening when it came time to put up the tents. Funny thing is, those camping disasters are some of my favorite memories now, and they're the stories that we repeat in hysterics over family dinners. Today we're going to spend some time talking about camping failures and telling camping stories, not quite around the campfire, but you can pretend. So share yours with us now by calling 1-800-639-2211. Again, that number is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your stories on our Facebook page. That way everybody in the world can see them. We're joined for some advice in how to avoid camping disasters by Frank Spaulding, Parks Project Coordinator for the Vermont State Park Service, and Sarah Clark, former commissioner of the Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation. Together, they star in the Tips and Tricks videos on the Vermont Park Service website. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
So I understand that you guys were actually camping this past weekend. Did you manage to stay dry, Frank?
We managed to stay pretty dry. We had a great weekend with our friends Pam and Brian, and we did have some rain that we dodged, but again, it made for some really good memories.
Sarah, how do you keep dry when you have rain coming down at you pretty much every day?
Lots and lots of tarps, and a lean-to is helpful, too.
A lean-to. So you actually have to rent that beforehand, though.
You do have to do that beforehand.
How often do you guys go camping?
We go at least a couple times a year.
Yeah.
And yet you are the faces of camping on the Park Service website. So I have to ask you, because in the Tips and Tricks videos, you guys star as a married couple with kids, and you talk a lot about here's how you can set up a tent, here's how you can have fun with kids, here's how you can avoid the rain. Now, in real life, you are still actually named Frank and Sarah, as your characters are named.
We sure are.
Yep. You're also engaged.
We are. Yeah.
You both have kids.
Yes.
So which came first, the faux relationship in the video or the real relationship?
The real one.
So you're not really out of character when you do these videos?
Not all the time, no.
Not all the time. So what's in character, Frank?
The water scene on the tarp. I think that was very much in character.
When he got doused.
Yes, that would never happen in real life.
Oh, no.
No.
Probably.
Do you have any real camping disasters that you can share with us? I mean, you've got to have something that can help you feel at one with the rest of humanity that has also had camping disasters. Sarah, you are enthusiastically nodding your head.
I don't know if it's a disaster, but definitely a funny story. I went camping a couple of years ago at a state park, and we're sitting around the campfire at night, and suddenly there's these domesticated skunks walking by.
That doesn't sound good from the start. Domesticated skunks.
It felt like they were your pets, a dog or a cat, but it was a skunk. And it took a little bit getting used to, but after a while, we didn't bother them and they didn't bother us, but you're still a little worried you're going to get sprayed.
Ooh, yeah, that sounds actually quite unpleasant.
Yes.
Were you there, Frank, or do you have another
No,
disaster?
That was actually, it's a great story about her camping with her friends, but there were no men there. That was her friends camping with their killed children.
And you, do you have a camping disaster you can share?
No real disaster. I mean, I think this weekend we watched our friends cook dinner for us, holding umbrella over the fire ring to keep the fire going, so we could keep cooking and smoke billowing around her head while the cooking went on. But we averted disaster, but it does make for nice memories.
So, Frank, you've never woken up to a wet sleeping bag?
I did a little time in the guard, and I woke up to a wet sleeping bag there, but not in a family camping trip, no.
We are talking today about camping disasters, and I promise we will have Frank and Sarah tell us a little bit about how to avoid them as well. But we're hearing from many of you already sharing your family disasters. Kathy says at North Carolina's Ocracoke Island Campground, there was only one tent left standing in the morning after a high windstorm, and it wasn't ours. Kit says we made it through three nights at Grand Isle, one trailer, two tents, and 12 people. Dry? Sort of. Joe says our camping disaster involves mosquitoes, the aroma of Atlantic Ocean shallows at low tide, a skunk, and a bagpipe player. Yes, it really happened. And Tracy says, I avoid camping disasters by staying in a hotel, which seems like that's just cheating. If you'd like to share your camping disasters with us, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or share your disaster story on our Facebook page, where you can, of course, also add photos. Let's go to Dorothy in Johnson. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi.
Got a disaster?
We camped at Nickerson State Park down in Massachusetts several years ago, and it poured. We were smart enough that we had trenched around our tent, but I don't think anybody else knew to do that. And we got up the first morning, and everybody had abandoned the camp except for us. And we spent the rest of the time digging people's laundry out of all of the little rivers that formed coming down towards the lakes. And once it finally stopped raining, after a couple of days, we hung everybody's laundry out and spent the next couple of days with everybody retrieving their clothes that had washed out of their tents.
I hope you got some extra hot dogs and s'mores for all of your hard work.
We got a few little treats. It was fun. And the camping I thought was great. You know, outside in a bathing suit and a raincoat, trenching out your tent. What better way to spend the summer?
Yeah, exactly. Dorothy, thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it. How about Kevin calling in from Rutland? Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How are you? You have a disaster for us?
I do. When I was in my early 20s, I lived in Wisconsin. And I had a friend who I went to school with who I discovered had never been camping before. So a few of us decided to take her camping, and we went to, the Black River Falls State Forest, which is a place where we had gone backpacking many times. And we drove up there, so we got there in time to, like, hike and set up camp for the night and, you know, settle down in our sleeping bags. On the hike in, we realized that the black flies and mosquitoes were pretty vicious. When we woke up the next morning, we realized also that there were a lot of carpenter ants, little tiny red ants, and ticks all over our campsite and all over us. So, needless to say, we wanted to get out of there pretty quick. So we packed up everything, and on the way out, we stopped at the outhouse. There was porcupine who had chewed his way into the outhouse and was not letting anyone else come in. So we got all these bugs. We got this porcupine. We got out of there. We drove back to Devil's Lake State Park, which was a pretty popular car camping state park kind of a place. And we were, you know, had a wonderful, relaxed evening there, swam in the lake, went to bed. About 2 o'clock in the morning, it was raining, and so I got up and wanted to make sure the tent flaps were closed. And as I'm leaning towards the tent flap, the front of the tent fell in on me, the back of the tent fell in on me, and pretty soon I realized that we're in about 6 inches of standing water, and it is pouring rain. So I woke up my friend, and we just grabbed the whole tent full of stuff and stuffed it in the trunk of the car and drove back home. So we got back to our homes about 3 o'clock in the morning, and when we woke up the next morning, we discovered that we had camped about 10 miles from Barneveld, which was a town that had been totally destroyed by a tornado.
Oh, well, Kevin, I guess learning about all of those disasters probably made it feel pretty small after finding out that you were that close to a tornado. But that sounds like one thing after another. Listeners, today we are talking about camping disasters. We're also going to get some tips for how to avoid them. You can share your favorite story on our Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We're sharing camping disaster stories today and learning a few good tips on how to avoid them from Frank Spaulding, Parks Project Coordinator for the Vermont State Park Service, and Sarah Clark, former Commissioner of the Department of Forests, Parks, and Recreation. And we'd love to hear your favorite stories of camping gone wrong. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 or email vermontedition@vpr.net. Tammy says, never hike in the White Mountains in a torrential thunderstorm. Good advice. Lee says, last year my dad and I went camping. I'm 13, and we forgot sleeping bags, but we did have a good time. Sue describes her camping disaster, saying, waking up in my tent 2 different times with an inch of water inside. Nothing better than waking up and lying in water. I don't like camping anymore. Give me a cabin. Speaking of which, Daniela says, rent a state park cabin, or at least a lean-to, as Sarah has recommended. The cabins are fabulous at the state parks, and no stress about getting soaked, especially with younger children. We had our best friends up with their kids all weekend from Boston at Button Bay, and though it was pouring here and there, the cabin made it easy and fun for everyone. That and pack the bug spray. The mosquitoes are fierce this year. Or is that every year. Again, you can share your thoughts with us. Write to vermontedition@vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. Now, Sarah Clark, a couple of people have mentioned wet tents. Mm-hmm. How can you avoid having a wet tent?
One of the things that we never leave without when we're going car camping is our air mattress and our air mattress pump. It leaves us about 4 to 5 inches off the floor. So if the water does come in, you do have that buffer against it. And I guess you could float away maybe too, but right. Hopefully not.
All right. But if you don't want any of the water inside your tent at all, Frank, what do you do?
One of the reasons I haven't had a disaster since my one time is that I spend a lot of time picking out the site for the tent, and you always pick the high ground. And we don't like to see people dig trenches around their tents in Vermont State Parks, but you can pick the place in the site that where the water runs away from your tent, and really, really take the time to make sure that if the rain does fall, it has a place to go that's not underneath your tent. And I think the trick I see a lot of people do is tuck the tarp underneath your tent so that it doesn't act as a catch for the rainwater. And I think that helps a lot of people out.
We used two tarps this weekend underneath our tent, and then we tied one above, and we were dry.
So really, you should probably invest in a few extra tarps just in case and bring them along with you even if the weather looks good.
You're car camping. There's no need to be a hero. You can bring what you need plus some. You might as well because you're going to forget something else. So you might as well have extra something.
That's right. If you're hiking in, you're not bringing the air mattress.
Correct.
Probably not.
Well, actually, Michael from North Walcott wrote in because he says, well, how about some stories about enjoying camping in the rain? And he has a similar advice. He says, use high, heavy line between two trees with a large tarp over the picnic table and maybe over the campfire, and voila, you have dry dining and camp cuisine. And he says the mistake people make with tents is omitting a plastic ground cloth that matches exactly the dimensions of the tent. Any excess needs to be folded carefully underneath so that running water runs under the plastic. So just reiterating what Frank said about making sure that you have that tarp so that it fits. You don't want it to be collecting rain that then goes up into your tent.
Correct.
All right, let's go to Joseph, who's calling in from Marshfield. Hi, Joseph. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, my friends Paul and Deb and my wife and I went camping in the Adirondacks about almost 30 years ago now, and we were aware that, of course, there were bears around. So at night before we put up the tents, we hung the food up in the trees, triangulating so that it would be hanging in the middle of the trees and away from us. Then we all went into our tents, fell asleep, and we had our backpacks at the foot of the tent, or near the door of the tent where our feet was. In the morning when we woke up, our backpacks were away from the tent. Hey. They had been ruffled through by bears. The food was down from the trees. The bears had gotten into everything, even taking the toothpaste out of the toothpaste tube. And the only thing they didn't eat was my friend Paul's home-baked bread, which we've ever since called Paul's bear-proof bread.
Oh, well, that sounds like an adventure, Joseph.
It was a great adventure, and so much so that Deb is now the Secretary of the Agency of Natural Resources.
So now we've got some dirt on Deb Markowitz. All right, Joseph, thanks very much. Speaking of bear encounters, I think we have another one from Mike in Peru, New York. Hey, Mike.
How are you?
Good, you?
Good, good, good.
You got a bear story?
Dodging raindrops. Yeah, when I was about 9 years old, about 50 years ago, our family went out to visit my uncle out in Idaho Falls, and we went to Yosemite. And of course, we had to picnic, and we had a station wagon, my aunt's station wagon, and Bobby, their son, and I were over, and we're checking things out. We looked in this culvert, and it was all black. And next time we looked, there's this bear head pulling out of it.
Ooh.
And so then it got black again, and we go running back to the picnic table, and there's a bear coming, there's a bear coming. And nobody would believe us, you know, 9-year-old, 10-year-old kid, what a great joke, right?
Right.
So then, you know, the table's about half set, and there's seven or eight of us, and all of a sudden out come this bear, and, oh, I don't know, it's maybe 75 feet to the table, and he's ambling along, and my Aunt Maggie, being a good West Coast lady, sacrifices her peach and tosses it to the bear, and he sits there eating it, and we all grabbed all our food and got it in the back of the station wagon and jumped in real quick. The bear ambles past and goes over to the next campground, And all of a sudden, there's this huge racket. And, you get out of here! Rah, 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 and sticks are flying, and that bear goes running up across the road and past another couple campsites, and then doubles back and catches these other campers totally with all their food out at the table. You know, of course, it was noon. He probably knew what time it was.
Yes, I hear that bears are now becoming very good at telling the time. Boy, Mike, thanks for that story, but... it sounds a little bit hair-raising as well. I mean, you don't really want to encounter a bear at your campsite. Mike got all of his food out of the way before the bear could get to it, which I guess is a good thing if you can do that safely. But Sarah, what do you do, A, to make sure that you are not attracting critters, and B, I mean, if you have a bear encounter, you can't climb a tree.
No, you can't. We always do make sure to either, we have to have our food in a high place, or we do leave it in the car. If there is an encounter with wildlife, leave them be.
Yeah.
Get out of the way. Yep.
Well, I mean, Mike said the table was set. They didn't have, it wasn't like they were, you know, leaving the food out while they were sleeping. They were just trying to have a nice lunchtime meal.
Yep.
Ooh. All right. So avoid the bears. Avoid the critters. We got a note from Carol who says, my son-in-law suggested using screwdrivers as tent pegs. I found some really sturdy ones that do the job at a local dollar store, and I can testify how it simplifies my campsite setup. You should try it. You know, one thing that brings up is that you can do what you want, what works to get your campsite in order. You don't have to make it look pretty. You don't have to have a campsite that is hardcore and rugged. I mean, Frank, for first-timers or people who maybe haven't camped since they were scouts, what do you recommend? I mean, how do you make it fun rather than something that you're trying to be the best camper and the most hardcore?
I think the thing to remember is just relax and go with it. And, you know, Vermont State Parks has a list online of items to bring, and use that as a base. Build on it, take from it. You know, you really make it your list. But it's a good place to start. You don't need everything in the world. Borrow what you don't have. Try stuff out. We've borrowed equipment from Sarah's dad. We're lending equipment to friends this weekend. You just need the basics. Don't overthink it. Use the list and just enjoy yourself and relax. Don't sweat the details when you go.
So, Sarah, you're saying it's okay to have an air mattress. It's okay to be comfortable. You don't have to sleep on the hard ground. I mean, this is something that's sort of revolutionary to many of us who grew up sleeping on the hard ground.
That's right. Definitely. I think people who sleep on the ground, it is kind of a badge of pride. I've done that myself, the tiny air mattress. But now I'm a little bit older and comfort's important. I bring my pillow from home. My son always brings an assortment of stuffed animals and, you know, games to play so that he has lots of fun too.
1-800-639-2211 is our number if you want to tell us about your camping disaster. You can also share camping advice with us. Go to vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition. You can let us know what you think makes for the best camping experience. Mark is calling in from Paulette. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. I have a story from back in my childhood. 1972, I was 9, my brother was 6, and we went with my parents and another couple camping in Blue Mountain Lake in the Adirondacks. And we were up there, and I guess a forest ranger, I don't recall exactly, came and told us that we needed to evacuate because Hurricane Agnes was approaching New York State. And my father said, it'll be fine. It's, you know, we're 200 miles inland. So we ended up spending the night there. My brother and I slept through the whole thing. My parents were up all night hearing and watching trees crashing all around our tents. We got up in the morning, and amazingly enough, both of our tents were fine. But all around us, there were trees, big trees falling all around us, and how we didn't get hurt or killed is amazing.
Oh, but Mark, it's still a story you remember now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it was the only time we ever went camping.
Oh, that's too bad. Mark, thanks for sharing your story. I appreciate that. Kevin's calling in from Burlington. Hey, Kevin, go ahead.
Hi. So 15 years ago, I went camping with a bunch of other families. And over Friday night, there was just a humongous rainstorm. We woke up the next morning, and people had abandoned the campsite. Tents were down, and just people were missing. But those of us that were left were just, kids, stay out of the puddles. But you couldn't. The water was everywhere. So I took a tarp off of somebody else's tent and put it on the little hill in front of my tent down into this gully that was full of water and turned it into a slip and slide. And all those kids got completely wet from head to toe, but we all had a blast doing it.
Kevin, thanks for the story. Appreciate that. And Frank Spaulding, I mean, that is really one of the things. If you're going to go out camping, if you have a disaster, you might as well have some fun with it.
Just have fun with it. I mean, that's a great story, you know, turning what could be a bad situation into a great one and a great memory, too. And I think if any message can go out, it's just relax and go with it. I mean, all the stories we hear are probably not the best times they had camping, but they sure are the most memorable ones. And why not make the memory, you know, and just have fun with it?
You and Sarah are both parents. How do you do that when you have kids and you're trying to make sure the kids are having fun and you're in charge of all of this gear that you're trying to deal with? And then maybe the kids are wet and tired and cranky and you're cranky. I mean, how do you make that happen?
I think be flexible. I think Sarah mentioned bringing a lot of toys and making sure you've overplanned and overstocked for the trip. And, you know, if it's not nap time but they're tired, sleep.
Right.
You know, don't worry about it. A nap in the middle of the day is one of the best things you can do camping. We took one this weekend.
Yeah, whether you have kids or not, frankly.
Well, yeah, a nap at any time is great when you're camping. So we took a good one this weekend. So.
We got a note from Sarah who says, years ago, my family went canoe camping up in Canada. I was 5 years old and my sister was 10. We shared a tent together and woke up very startled in the middle of the night when we heard scuffing and snorting outside of our tent. Things got really scary when the tent started to lift up at one end. My sister screamed and off ran a giant moose. Apparently, we had set up our tent right in its nightly path.
Dear.
Lesson learned. Elizabeth says, if you live already quietly in the woods, don't go camping at a large campground. And if you do make that mistake, do not bring your idiot dog along. The dog would probably object to that description, but... You know, that may be a good point. If you have to sort of choose your campsite wisely. I mean, you don't want to, if you're a quiet liver, go out into a huge campground where there are going to be lots of different kinds of campers. How do you research and pick out where to camp, Sarah?
The internet. Vermont State Parks website is a great resource.
And Frank?
And I think we have Vermont State Parks has a lot of variety in terms of types of campgrounds to offer, from the family car camping campground to some really walk-in remote sites where if you want to camp or recreate quietly, that's the park for you. But the bigger parks on the 4th of July weekend might not be. But they sure are a lot of fun if that's what you're going to enjoy.
Yeah, and if you have a big family and a lot of friends, it might be great to have your friends be able to bike around and make friends with other kids at the campground.
And, you know, and we went and camped with friends this weekend. That's a really great way to have a good time camping in a campground like that and just get away from the yard work and just really enjoy yourself.
Let's go to Tom in Keysville, New York. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Hey, how are you?
Great.
Hey, you guys talk a lot about summer camping, but we do a lot of winter camping. We're in the Adirondacks, and a bunch of my friends and I rented some guides and went to the Gulf of Slides on Mount Washington, and we're telemark skiers, so we skied in, and it took us quite a while to get up there. Heavy snow, and so once we got there, we set up camp and skied back down, climbed back up to find that there had been 3 avalanches that had happened in the time that we'd come out, that we had to ski across, but we decided to tough it out and spent the night, and in the morning, it had snowed so hard that their tent had collapsed on us. And we ended up having to dig our guides out because they couldn't get out of their tent. And also an avalanche had stopped about 100 feet from our tent, kind of hairy. So we decided to hoof it on out of there and give up.
Yeah, Tom, I would too. But boy, a good story and a good reminder that you can actually camp all year round. You don't have to camp at this time of year. There's great camping to be had on the shoulder seasons as well, a little bit less crowded. Yep. And winter camping, what a fun adventure. Before we let you guys go, Sarah and Frank, any other advice you have for people who are still on the fence or looking at the weather report for the next 10 days and thinking, yeah, forget it, I'm not going camping?
I think in Vermont this summer, if you want to enjoy it, you got to get out in the rain. Just go for it.
Yeah, and just enjoy it.
I couldn't say it any better than that. Just go for it.
Frank Spaulding is Parks Project Coordinator for the Vermont State Park Service. Sarah Clark is former Commissioner of the Department of Forests, Parks, and Recreation. Together, they star in the tips and tricks videos on the Vermont State Park Service website. We'll put a link up at vpr.net so you can watch their Hollywood-style movies. Sarah, Frank, thanks very much.
Thanks
for having us.
Thank you. when the Vermont State Hospital was flooded during Tropical Storm Irene, it wasn't just the building itself that was lost. There were also over 100 years of administrative records stored in the basement of the building. Some of those records were lost forever, but over 40 cubic feet of material was rescued and has been transferred to the state archives, where they're now open to the public. Marisa Dobrik is an archivist at the State Archives. She was responsible for cataloging the state hospital records, and she joins us now. Marisa, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
These were administrative records, so you're not putting out there for the public people's medical records.
That's correct.
So what is included?
There's a whole host of pretty interesting records, things along the lines of photographs, community meetings, newspaper clippings, scrapbooks. There's also land deeds from the property as it was acquired. There's training records from the nursing program, some financial records, and then clinical studies that were done by staff at the hospital. And then there are some patient ledgers that are open just to family members.
When we keep reporting and hearing reported in the media 40 cubic feet of material, that's such a weird way to describe public records. What does that actually mean in terms of how many records we're talking about?
Well, in this case, it was such a variety of material and many different sizes. So we used cubic feet instead of the record boxes because it's kind of hard to imagine them in that way. But I'd say a standard archive box of material is 1 cubic feet.
Okay.
And
all right.
So, but then there's many negatives, and especially glass plate negatives from like the 1920s, and those are in much smaller boxes to preserve the material for a long time.
So, among the things that you found and you've been archiving and looking through are some medical studies. Can you describe them?
Yeah, I mean, the clinical studies is kind of the term that they used, and that's from the 1940s to the 1990s. Many of the chief staff superintendents did studies on a variety of things. That's when things were starting to begin medically, so occupational therapy studies, group therapy, everything from vocational training. The most interesting is something that was called the Vermont Story, and that was long-term study of the rehabilitation of patients with schizophrenia.
Hmm.
And that started in the 1950s, 1955, and it continued on and was even followed up in like the 1980s. So it was a very long-term look at changes in schizophrenia and getting them out of the hospitals and into communities.
Was that the main takeaway that you found, was that there was a move from institutionalization into more community-based living?
That's what I'd say was the overall goal. I mean, I think early on there was just a lack of understanding of what mental illness was, so it was an attempt to get them out of poor farms where they were ill-equipped to help them and into places where there was at least some training. There was doctors, there was people to take care of them. But at the same time, obviously the deinstitutionalization is recorded here as they try to find better ways to deal with those kinds of ailments.
I understand there's also a fair amount of patient artwork that's been saved in these files.
There is. It's one small box, actually, but it's pretty interesting. Now, the copyright of that still belongs to the individuals, but the patient artwork was maintained by the hospital in their archives as examples of the things that they were interested in or examining. So there's a variety of themes like trains seem to fascinate some of the patients, and it's really quite moving.
Trains? Why trains, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, maybe Waterbury being situated close enough that they could hear a train might have had some inspiration. Also, later, they were allowed to go on trips, and those are documented in some of the photographs, so they might have gone or had people speak to them about trains.
You just mentioned photographs, and there are quite a few photographs that are also preserved in these documents. Do you have any that you can describe for us?
Sure. I had two that stood out the most to me. One of them is probably 1900s, and it's a group of men in one of the wards. They're the patients, and they're sort of, some of them are looking straight at the camera and some of them aren't. There's a couple who are convalescing, so they're in wheelchairs. One of them has a bandage over his eye, And there's a woman who's one of the orderlies, I believe, and she's looking away from the camera while some of the other gentlemen orderlies are kind of there at attention.
And we don't know who these people are?
We don't. Some of the scrapbooks we have from the 1940s do say who the individuals are, oftentimes the doctors and staff. Early on, the staff's family members would live there as well, so there's a fair number of family photographs with no identifying information.
So if people want to be able to have a look at these archives themselves, they're available for public research? People can go and look through most of them?
That's correct. That's Tuesday through Friday at 9 to 4 are public hours.
And what isn't available to look at?
Excuse me?
What isn't available for people to look at?
So that would be information that's restricted related to public. So medical records are not open. And then some of the slides that deal with medical individuals are no longer open.
We just have a couple of seconds left, but what do you hope is done with these records now that they are available to the public? Are people going to do research that you think might be valuable?
I would hope so. There was a book done by Nancy Gallagher that was called Empty Beds, and that helped me a great deal while I was looking at these records, but I think there's a lot more to be taken out. And as an archivist, I can get an idea, but I can't research. So I hope people will come and see them and find out more for us.
Marisa Dobrik is one of the archivists at the Vermont State Archives. She was responsible for cataloging the state hospital records saved after Tropical Storm Irene. Most of those records are available for public research. Marisa, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
That music means it's time for our weekly summer school lesson. So without further ado, let's get right to it.
I'm Kim Goodling, and we're at Vermont Grandview Farm. Today, I'm going to show you how to take wool and spin it into yarn on the spinning wheel. So what I'm going to do, I have some brown wool, I have some blue wool, and I have some orange wool, and I'm going to feed them through the drum carder so that the colors blend together. A drum carder has a great big drum that has a cloth on it that has metal teeth. And these metal teeth are what comb the fibers. It's sort of like combing your own hair and getting the tangles and knots out of your hair. I have a fork that I use to lift the fiber, and then I roll it off of the drum. It comes off the drum very easily. Now what I have is a bat that is ready to go to the spinning wheel and be spun into yarn. I have a Majacraft spinning wheel, which has two pedals, and both of the pedals work to spin the wheel. The golden rule is always take your shoes off before you sit at a spinning wheel. For me, spinning is a very tactile activity, and it's not just what I'm feeling with my hands, but what I'm feeling with my feet. As I'm pedaling, I'm taking the wool and I'm actually pulling the fibers. The spinning wheel can't take a huge hunk of wool on it at one time, and so I want to pull the fibers out, so it's just taking a smaller amount of wool. To get the yarn off the bobbin, take what's called a nitty knotty, and you wrap the yarn around this nitty-knotty, and it forms a skein. Sometimes if I'm going to knit right away, when I take it off the bobbin, I will use my ball winder, and I will wind it into a ball. I knit all the time, and I tell my children that I knit so I don't kill people. It's cheaper than therapy, and it works great.
That was Kim Goodling from Grandview Farm in Washington, Vermont. Kim teaches spinning and felting classes, in case that wasn't enough for you. And we'll put pictures up on our Facebook page so you can get a sense of what all of that looked like. Next week in summer school, we'll teach you how to dance so you won't be left sitting at a table next time you are at a wedding. But tomorrow, the real estate market. We hear murmurs that nationally the market is rebounding. But what does that mean in Vermont, where the lows are never as low and the highs, unfortunately, aren't as high? Tell us what you've noticed this summer, whether you're trying to buy, trying to sell, or just checking out the prices in your neighborhood. Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us tomorrow. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson and Annie Pruitt. Neil Charnoff directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.